Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Krause, and I hope you're staying happy, healthy, and safe. It's a big show, so let's get right at it. Later in the show, we'll meet first-time Métis author Willie Pohl. Her new book for kids, Together We Drum, Our Hearts Beat as One, is a simple story of a little Indigenous girl who comes up against a monster called hate. The little girl calls upon her ancestors to help her drum up the courage through song to overcome hate. Beautifully illustrated by Chief Lady Bird, it is a moving and powerful book about Indigenous resistance and ancestral connection. That's a little bit later on. We'll also meet Swedish filmmaker Ruben Östlund. At the Cannes Film Festival, his movie Triangle of Sadness received an 8-minute standing ovation and won the top prize, the Palme d'Or. It's a really dark satire, an over-the-top tale of hypocrisy, greed, and ambition that is about as subtle as a punch to the face, but I loved it, and I'll tell you all about it just a little bit later on. First, though, let's meet award-winning journalist and editor-in-chief of the Hamilton Spectator, Paul Burton. His new book, Shopomania, Our Obsession with Possession, is a thought-provoking and provocative challenge to consumerism. It is a sassy and satirical look at today's consumer culture that asks, do we really need all this stuff? Paul Burton joined me via Zoom. What led to the writing of Shopomania? Was there one thing that happened? I know your mother was an early environmentalist, so that may have had something to do with it, sitting in the back of your head. But what was it?
Well, I grew up in a crazy household with 8 kids and dogs and cats and a lot of guests and a lot of stuff. And my mother, in addition to being an environmentalist and a recycler and a reuser, just simply refused to get rid of stuff. And the rest of us seem to acquire it at an increasing rate.
And was that ever in the back of your mind as you were looking at writing this book, which is about shopping and acquiring and perhaps the ideas that we don't need all the things that we have? Do you think your early life played into that?
I expect it did, but probably my adult life had an ongoing effect as I saw how some other cultures lived and how I realized what we needed and what we didn't. And I've always found that I don't like the term minimalism, but I found a certain calming effect not in an ordered household, but a household that I can find things easily.
And
my
so
my mother had what she called a glory drawer when I was a kid. By the time I was 10, there were 2 glory drawers, and by the time I was 15, there were 3. And you could never find a pair of pliers or scotch tape when you needed it.
I'm sure that television show Hoarders is not on your regular PBR list.
Not exactly. No.
No. The book has an irreverent tone. So tell me about coming up with some of the terminology you use. And I love some of these. You shopaganda, contra shop, the shopperati. So let's start there and talk about what they mean and how you came up with them.
Right. So the book is set out as a sort of a glossary or a lexicon of what I call shoponyms or invented terms to help us discuss the matter that sort of takes over our entire lives. So, there's, for example, blotto shop, shopping while drunk, or ultra shop, which is what rich people do, or shopaganda. This is the lies that people tell, the way that sort of Donald Trump might talk about his buildings being higher than they are. Or
right.
a shopostle is someone who moves product. And there are stories connected with each one of these or many of these glossary terms. It's just a way of explaining to people how they might use them in the future, which would be terrific if they did and they became part of the modern lexicon.
Well, I found that it made the book very user-friendly for me. This is a big topic because it brings together a lot of topics that sometimes people... I don't want to say that they don't want to think about them, but environmentalism is something that we are so constantly reminded of and how we should be better environmentalists. And you wonder, okay, how does that connect to shopping? Well, the more you shop, the less you're recycling probably. And just the more garbage and junk we're amassing. And so I found that the slightly irreverent tone of those brought me in and sort of gently pushed me through the book in a way that I found quite reassuring and kind of a nice doorway to walk through.
Yeah, it's often silly, but always serious. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a very serious theme underlying it all about, you know, the planet's ability to bear the weight of all this stuff. But I didn't want to burden readers with a lot of statistics and data that are available in other books. I wanted to tell them stories about people's stuff and whether it made them happy or not.
You're listening to Paul Burton on The Richard Krause Show. His new book, Shopomania, Our Obsession with Possession, is available now wherever you buy fine books. And sustainable living is I think, one of the things that comes out of this book, because when you hear those stories, you have to consider if the way that you're living is sustainable and you know, how moving forward might you become more sustainable. So, you know, there's a bit of spoonfuls of sugar, I think, worked within the book, but there's very serious things being discussed.
Exactly. It's a book that appears to be about shopping, but it is actually an environmental and social study.
Which also mentions a lot of celebrities. So let's talk a little bit within these stories and things that you tell. Let's talk about how celebrity culture influences what we consume. And I also think that celebrity culture has changed a great deal over the years. We are now buying more things than ever. And I think the introduction of online influencers and created lives, or curated lives rather, on Instagram are pushing us towards more consumption, different ways of expressing materialism. What is your take on it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's we love celebrities. I've been in the newspaper business long enough to know what people want. Or they want to read about politics and culture, but they really also want to read about what celebrities are buying or selling. Mm-hmm. So these celebrities, whether they're, mega movie stars like George Clooney, or whether selling, tequila or coffee, or whether they're, what I would call obscure, but probably not all obscure at all, influencers with 2.5 million followers on TikTok or Instagram.
And do you think that we're shopping more than ever? I said that earlier. I have no statistic to back that up, but I assume that it's true. There's more people in the world, and I think we are shopping more than ever.
Yeah, I think the world is shopping more. I think some of us, as we age, suddenly come across, the realization, I've got too much stuff, and what did I get it for? And I can't use it anymore. And, I'm only here for a limited amount of time on the planet. But yeah, the developing world is, it'd be nice to think that the developed world is out, all shopped out. But the developing world is just coming into its own. And, you can see this around the world and in newspapers and television and social media, that it's, every other item is about something to buy.
I also think that it has something very much to do with our skill set as humans. My grandmother would darn a pair of socks. My father could fix anything, and I can neither darn a pair of socks or fix all that much, anything meaningful around the house. And I think it is a skill that a generation has lost here. And so instead of darning the socks, we go out and buy a new pair, which means one pair of socks is going into a landfill somewhere.
Exactly. And not only can we not darn the socks, there's really no point, because stuff is so cheap, notwithstanding the complaints about inflation. I mean, stuff is really, really cheap these days. So there's hardly a point in buying a new or repairing a pair of shoes the way I do, when you can just go out and buy, the latest fashion.
What are some tips that you would suggest that people might think about in terms of curbing their consumerism?
What I do is I'm like everyone else. I want stuff. I shop. I buy a lot of things that I regret. I'm not immune to it. And there are lots of sort of self-incriminating stories in the book about this. But But what I like to do, if I really want something, I look at it and I say, how badly do I want it? Mm. And usually I don't want it badly enough. If I still want it the next day or the next week, then I know, okay, I'm going to go get it. So I just like to put a bit of a time lapse on it and see what that brings.
Globally, what is to be done about consumerism? The cork is out of the bottle, as far as I can tell.
You know, I think that, as I say in the book, I think that things are going to get better. They look pretty bad at the moment, because you're right, we're shopping more than ever. Mm-hmm. But I think we're looking at, we're you know, the clothing industry, for example, which is one of the greatest environmental threats to the planet. They're coming along, too slowly, of course, but they're coming along. Mm-hmm. One of the ones that drives me crazy is bottled water, right? We're shipping bottled water across the oceans back and forth. You know, we're shipping it to France and France is shipping it. I like, try and figure it out. I can't. But I do think that the cost of disposing of stuff, which has been rising in recent years, will indeed make people think, oh, I'm going to have to get rid of this, and I can't just throw it in, drag it to the sidewalk on Monday. I have to, I'm going to have to pay to get rid of it. And I think, the cost of renovations, this is one of the things that, architects and renovators work into their prices.
Well, Paul, thank you very much. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Paul Burton on The Richard Krause Show. His new book, Shopomania, Our Obsession with Possession, is available now wherever you buy fine books. Let's get to know Swedish filmmaker Ruben Östlund. His latest film, starring Woody Harrelson as an anarchist yacht captain, is a singular film. Triangle of Sadness is an audacious mix of Louis Bunuel and South Park. Although often grotesque, it entertains and provokes thought. Divided into three sections, Triangle of Sadness begins with an examination of the dynamic between men and women in the form of two supermodels. At dinner, they fight over the bill when she makes no effort to pony up some cash, even though she makes about twice as much money than he does. In their superficial world, the real currencies are good looks and social media followers, she thinks, but he feels if they are to be truly equals, they mustn't let money come between them, with one lording their wealth over the other. The second, must-be-seen-to-be-believed sequence is a social satire of the highest and grisliest order. Set aboard a luxury yacht, the two supermodels, invited because they're well-known, beautiful people, are joined by a rogues gallery of ultra-rich folks used to flaunting their privilege. At the helm is Captain Thomas Smith, played by Harrelson, a drunken American communist who deliberately schedules the fancy captain's dinner during a patch of extremely rough weather. As the waves rock the ship, the motion of the ocean, coupled with some spoiled seafood, leads to mass seasickness and a ballet of bodily fluids. Both sections dovetail into an apocalyptic third sequence that examines social hierarchies and what can happen when the powerless get a taste of power. Triangle of Sadness is quite unlike anything else that you've ever seen, and it's playing now in theaters. Here's director Ruben Östlund.
The success of a luxury cruise mainly depends on you. I don't want to hear anybody saying no. It's always, yes, sir, yes, ma'am.
I command you, enjoy the moment.
No.
No?
No.
What? You say no to me?
No, no.
Oh, so it's yes?
Yes, no.
Yes?
The ship is going under.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just the song, but for everyone.
This is really bad. This is really, really bad.
I grew up in the era of the great disaster movies, and The Poseidon Adventure was a particular favorite of mine, and it came to mind while I was watching this film, and I wonder if it was of any influence on you at all, because it's got some of the trademarks. There's the disaster, there's the strong person that takes the lead, there's a lot of things going on there. Was that in your head at all?
Not that particular movie, actually, but there were some other movies that I, of course, had to relate to in some way. When it comes to this survival on a deserted island and power structures that are turned upside down and so on. There's one movie called Swept Away by Lina Wertmüller that when I was pitching the project, someone said to me, you have to watch it. And I watched it, and I really, really think it's great. And then it has the similar kind of setup a little bit. But to use the island and the after-catastrophe scenario, so to speak, is a really efficient way to look at hierarchies and structures. And especially maybe in our times, you know, when someone's profession is to take pictures of yourself, and you're super, super good at that. But what happens when you end up on a deserted island and it's know-how on fishing and doing fire that is the most valuable skill? So, like, I just get happy when I think about the setup.
Well, the power structure certainly is turned upside down by the time we get to the island. And I don't know how much we want to give away about this, because I don't want to spoil this for anybody. But the power structure is turned upside down. And I thought that's, for me, where the real kind of satire came from, because you had these very wealthy people who, for me, just became like children, like babies almost, on the island, because they had never had to really do anything for themselves.
That is a big part why I was curious to make the film in these three parts, because it takes place in first the fashion world, then on a luxury yacht, and then it ends up on a deserted island.
You're listening to film director Ruben Östlund on The Richard Krauss Show. His new film, Triangle of Sadness, is in theaters now.
And the structure that is, for an example, on a luxury yacht, it's interesting to see the relationship between the people working and the passengers. They have absurd demands. When I did the research, I heard about they had a problem in the master bedroom because they had a jacuzzi in the master bedroom. And this provoked a bad behavior from the rich the rich people who were going on the boat, because they said, can we fill up the jacuzzi with champagne? And that happened a couple of times. And but then they felt they had enough when they said, we want to fill up the jacuzzi with champagne and goldfishes. Then they were like, okay, we have to move the jacuzzi from the master bedroom because this provokes a bad behavior. So I thought it says something about being on top. And, you know, when I'm making the films, I always try to relate with the possibility for me to do the same. I have to understand how someone can become, like, ignorant in that way or... but it is actually hard to understand some of the behavior.
Absolutely it is, but I think that you're in an interesting position because you go to the Cannes Film Festival, you have big American movie stars in your film. You must have an insight to it on some level.
Yeah, one thing that I think is the prejudice that we have is that rich and famous people are egoistic and superficial, and poor people are nice and genuine. Right. And I mean, unfortunately, or not unfortunately, as soon as you come close to any human being, you just see another human being. So I think it's almost like a middle-class way of justifying the class society. Right. Yeah, at least the rich people, they are so, they don't know the true values in life, you know. It's not true. They are just nice, normal people, and they are being fortunate in this structure and this kind of system that we have. So a friend of mine said, rich people are nice, and he's right, you know. They just don't like to pay tax. That's the problem.
You shot this, I was fascinated to learn this, on the Christina O.
Yes.
That's the Aristotle Onassis yacht. And that, I mean, I did some reading on it. Marilyn Monroe was there. Winston Churchill, Kennedy, Maria Callas, they've all spent time on this yacht. So tell me a little bit about the yacht itself.
The yacht is, it's like an old, kind of beautiful... I think it's from the 50s or the 40s or something like that. I mean, for me, it has a symbol value, of course, because it was like the Western elite that was hanging out on that boat in the 70s. And I thought it was fun to use it as a symbol value and blow it up in the film, you know. I'm spoiling again, but okay, it doesn't matter. You have to see what it looks like when we blow it up. And I mean, he was an iconic person also in the history of Greece, and we shot the film in Greece. Also, the deserted island is shot in Greece. So it was interesting to get on board on that boat and know about the history of it.
Did the pandemic affect your shooting at all? It must have.
Yes.
So that's the that made me think of the abandoned islands in Greece.
You can think of like the second day of shooting, we get to know about like the pandemic is in Italy and it's getting closer. And we have a shooting that is like all this crazy location. It made us very, very nervous. And we had to stop the production two times. I think we did over 1,200 COVID tests, and all of them were negative, luckily. So it was a stress factor, but it was also beautiful because it brought the team together. So there was no room for small arguments or anything like that. We were working together in a really good way.
The sails. Do you think it's possible to wash them?
I don't think that's possible, ma'am, because this is a motorized vessel.
Yeah.
So we don't have any sails.
It was sails, yes.
Well then, in that case, we will clean the sails.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
You're listening to film director Ruben Östlund on The Richard Krauss Show. His new film, Triangle of Sadness, is in theaters now.
A Russian capitalist. And an American communist.
On a $250 million luxury yacht.
This is a satire, but it seems to me that it moves beyond satire somehow. Like, how do you see it? Because I've seen it. I've been trying to explain to people without giving it away what it is.
Yeah.
But it's social commentary, absolutely. It's satire, but there's other layers here. What do you see?
I think it's hard to put a genre on it, but it's almost the easiest way to explain that it's both humor and some serious elements to it also. So that's why satire is maybe the best word to explain it with. I have not been really inspired by other satires. I've been inspired by Larry David and Mikkel Haneke. These two are my two. So it's in the middle of Larry David and Mikkel Haneke, I would say.
So Curb Your Enthusiasm and Funny People. Somewhere in the middle there, that's where you exist.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a quote here from you where you say, all my films are about people trying to avoid losing face. Why is that important to you?
Because I think we are a herd animal, we are a group animal. We are so affected by how other people look at us. We are so terrified of being excluded from the group. And in this film, I got very interested in how the fashion industry are selling their clothes by using this primal fear that we have of being excluded and losing face. And I can briefly tell you about it. It's very interesting. It was a scientist that was looking at zebras on the savanna. And he was asking himself, why do they have a white and black pattern instead of a sandy yellow fur in order to hide?
To camouflage.
Yeah, exactly. And he tried to follow one individual in the herd. Turns out it's very hard because they disappear in the herd immediately. And then he sprayed a red dot on the side of one of the zebras, and then he could follow it. But the consequence was also that very quickly it got taken by lions. So when the lions can spot one individual, they can tire it out and then they can catch it. And he was drawing parallels to the fashion world. I mean, we are using clothes in the same way. We are camouflage that we put on in order to blend in a special social group. So the one that we identify ourselves connecting to. Then it's very efficient if the fashion world is changing fashion like every fall and every spring, because then we have to consume more clothes. So that's just one aspect of our fear to lose face or to do something that is considered awkward or strange in the eyes of the other of our herd.
You're listening to film director Ruben Östlund on The Richard Krauss Show. His new film, Triangle of Sadness, is in theaters now. On top of all of this, you have a Marxist captain played by Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
And the introduction of Woody Harrelson in this film is so interesting because we only hear him for quite an extended period of time.
Yeah.
And then when we finally do meet him, we're not quite exactly sure what to think of him. And then he starts spouting Karl Marx, and it goes from there. So tell me about creating that character, because it's singular. I don't know that I've seen that before.
No, okay. I think that maybe, you know, Tintin, Hergé, the comic book, Captain Haddock is maybe like, but I don't know. But it was really fun. It was Woody did a fantastic work on this character. And I just told him, in order to try to convince him to play the role, I said, okay, you're going to be a Marxist captain on a luxury yacht, and every cruise you try to have the captain's dinner, a 7-meal course, when the weather gets rough, so all the passengers get super seasick. You will get really, really drunk together with a Russian oligarch, and you will play around with the mic system, reading communist manifest to this and throwing up passengers. And he's like, yes, I want to do this. And then we had a lot of fun discussion. How should we introduce the character? And it's fun when you have someone that is as known as Woody is, to play with the idea, like you just hear his voice. Mm-hmm. And finally, when it comes out, okay, Woody Harrelson.
That was Ruben Östlund on The Richard Krause Show. His new film, Triangle of Sadness, is in theaters now. And now, as promised, let's meet Métis author Willy Pohl. Her new book for kids, Together We Drum, Our Hearts Beat as One, is a simple story of an indigenous girl who comes up against a monster called hate and calls upon her ancestors to help her drum up the courage through song to overcome. Beautifully illustrated by artist Chief Lady Bird, it is a moving and powerful book about indigenous resistance and ancestral connection. Willy Pohl joined me via Zoom. You say that this book stemmed from a trip with one of your students on the Highway of Tears. What did that trigger for you?
Yeah, a huge part of it did. I think there was definitely multiple events in my 10 years of teaching and education that really kind of stayed in my head for a long time and kind of built the base of the story. But the icing on the cake, so to speak, was, a trip where I didn't realize where we were going. I was going to look at a horse, and I'm from Ontario, so I wasn't super familiar with geography in BC. I'd, of course, heard of the Highway of Tears. I didn't know exactly where it was. And so when I had said that I was going to go look at this horse, someone said, oh, you better take someone with you. Like, you shouldn't make that drive by yourself. And I didn't really understand. I thought, oh, okay, well, I guess it'll be kind of lonely. Like, that makes sense. And so at the time I had been teaching, and she was a high school student and she's great with horses. And I thought, oh, perfect. Do you want to come with me on this trip and you can have a look at this horse with me? And we started driving, and it was like, all of a sudden there was just sign after sign of missing women. Some of them like as young as 12. And I just started to feel like really nauseous. And I remember asking her, are we on the Highway of Tears? And very nonchalantly, she just kind of said, yeah. And I couldn't believe how normal it was for her. She'd obviously done this drive before. She knew exactly where we were. And it was so, normalized for her. And for me, it was devastating. Like, all of these signs from years, like people who won't have answers, from 10 years ago. And it was just really hit home for me, for sure.
On the surface, it's kind of about a monster, but that monster can be seen as a metaphor for lots of things, for racism, for missing and murdered indigenous women. There's a lot going on here, but this is a children's book. So tell me a little bit about massaging the story so that you don't scare the heck out of kids, but make sure that your message comes through loud and clear.
Yeah, so I think that, whenever I tell people that I wrote a book that stems from missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, for kids, I always kind of get those questions, and I always kind of get some weird looks, for sure. I think there's a couple different parts to this, because I think that Indigenous kids who are usually very familiar with missing and murdered Indigenous women, it's usually affected them, it's affected their community. And so in a way, we do have young children who are exposed to this because they don't have any other option. It's affecting their life now. And so a large part of it was written for Indigenous kids to kind of just give them more resources to see an empowering story with an Indigenous lead character, especially a young girl, but also written in a way that's kind of in lyrical rhyme. It flows really nicely. The imagery is really beautiful. And it just kind of glosses over some of the MMIWG2S things. And so I think, for a lot of kids, they won't even notice some of the like hidden elements. And I think that that's really up to the parents if they want to dive deeper into those elements or not. But it's there if you want to, and there's, you know, a lot of resources to do that. But if you don't want to and you're not comfortable, I still think it's a beautiful story of kind of Indigenous resilience and connection to culture.
Well, they'll certainly be drawn in by the artwork, which is absolutely fantastic. So the full page illustrations are done by Chief Ladybird. Tell me a little bit about connecting with them and how you decided to work on this book together.
Yeah, so I had been following Chief Ladybird on Instagram for a long time. I was a huge fan. And I kind of remember when someone asked me, like, who would your dream illustrator be? And I said, Chief Ladybird. They kind of looked at me like, good luck. because she's super busy and, you know, and she's super popular and her artwork is everywhere. And it's so powerful. And it's, you know, there's no surprise that she's has such a great following and so many fans. So when I initially reached out, she initially told me she was too busy and I tried again and sent her the story and she read it and she fell in love with it just as much as I did and said yes. And I think that's kind of when I knew that she was the absolute perfect person, because for someone to kind of connect in a way with the words that was almost as powerful as how I connect with it being the writer, it was just incredible to see what she did with it. And I'm a first time author. I had no tips or tricks. Like I didn't know what I wanted on any of the pages, but she just came back with something so stunning.
Oh, so you didn't collaborate. I'm using that word in quotation marks. It wasn't so much a back and forth as it was, here's the work. This is what I've done. Now you add your layer to it.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a little bit of back and forth. Generally, an author will kind of give some notes about what they want on each page. I didn't really have that. I don't really have an artistic mind for visual arts. And so she kind of, yeah, there was a few pages where she said, you know, do you have, you know, I'm kind of stumped on this page. What do you think we should put here? And we would chat. And then, like, just from us talking, we kind of created some of the ideas, I guess, but largely, yeah, it's definitely the visuals are all her for sure.
And let's talk about your love of storytelling. I've read that it dates back to your grandfather, and he told you stories about running trap lines and all sorts of things from his life. Is that where your love of storytelling comes from?
Largely, I think so. He was definitely a big storyteller. I never really knew if he was telling the truth or not. He actually used to tell me a story when I was a kid about how my great-grandmother, so like his grandma, was born in a canoe. And I always thought he was like just totally pulling my leg. And then we found a news article years later that actually documented that she was born in a canoe. So wow. I think, as a great storyteller, I definitely couldn't tell which ones were true and not. But yeah, I think that's definitely sparked a lot of where it comes from.
You're listening to author Willie Pohl on The Richard Krause Show. Her book, Together We Drum, Our Hearts Beat as One, is available wherever fine books are sold.
I think there's so much power in storytelling, like especially when we want to kind of get people involved in our causes and kind of get people passionate about making a difference, especially on something with missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. A lot of the population don't think that it's their problem necessarily. I always get things like, oh, well, it's kind of an Indigenous problem. Like, where do I fit into it? And so I think like the power of storytelling is really about drawing those people in and showing them that it kind of is everyone's problem and that we all need to make a difference for it to change. And there's so much power in storytelling. Yeah, it's really incredible to see. I get messages all the time of people who've like started crying reading it, and they, you know, it invokes a lot of emotion, and I really, really have loved that part of it.
It's a story too of empowerment and confidence for children. As a teacher, how do you try and instill those qualities into the young people that you are mentoring and teaching?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like I definitely work only really in Indigenous spaces with Indigenous youth. And I think a huge part of it is that they're so unaware of the knowledge and the talent that they already have. And, you know, like I see a lot of traditional ecological knowledge in youth all the time when we're out on the land. And I just, they're sometimes they're so, yeah, like so unaware. They just don't know how valued it is. And I think that really just helping them to see what they already have is the most important thing. I mean, as much as I want to say that I'm a great teacher and I'm very inspiring, I would say that 99% of the time I'm the one being inspired by youth. And so it's more about just making them see how they are through my own eyes.
One last question here, and it's unrelated to the book, but it grabbed my eye. And I just have to ask, what is the trick to managing a dog sled team with up to 25 dogs? I've never done it, but I've seen films. It looks impossible, but you do it.
Well, as you said, the power of storytelling. So I instilled in me that I could be anything I wanted to be and that our ancestors ran dogs. And right. I grew up watching the movie Iron Will on repeat, which is an old dog sledding movie. And I think that I'm crazy is really the only answer. I don't think that there is a lot of skill involved, but I think at first when you step on the runners and you get that like adrenaline feeling, and for me, I had no idea what I was doing. The first team I ran was maybe about 6 dogs, and I felt like that was the most powerful thing I'd ever felt. I felt like I had no control. I had no idea what I was doing. And to go from that in the same year to running, like up to 25 dogs, generally around 18, was pretty wild. I think just a lot of self-confidence that maybe isn't earned, a lot of blind self-confidence.
Well, that must feel though like a rocket taking off when they're all running in unison and you're in charge of it. They're trained, but you're still holding the reins. You are in charge, but it has to really be quite something when it first happens.
Yeah, there's definitely the moment where they're all jumping and you're kind of you have a quick release rope and you're just kind of waiting to pull it. And the minute you pull it, you're gone. And although a dog musher is somewhat in control, there's no stopping them really. I've been in situations where I've had to flip the sled and drag for 20 feet just to try and get them to stop. They don't know the word stop really.
Wow.
And it can get pretty crazy. It's a really amazing feeling. And it was a big part of my life for a long time.
Well, that's super cool. That's very, very cool. Well, Willie, thanks so much. What a pleasure to speak to you about this.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
That was Willie Pohl on The Richard Krause Show. I very much enjoyed talking to her about her book, Together We Drum, Our Hearts Beat as One, which is available wherever fine books are sold. I also loved hearing about piloting a 25-dog sled team. That's an incredible story. Big thanks also to Swedish filmmaker Ruben Östlund. Check out his movie Triangle of Sadness in theaters right now. Big thanks to Paul Burton. Find his book Shopomania, Our Obsession with Possession, in fine bookstores across the country. It's a smart and funny book that just might make you think twice the next time you go shopping. Of course, as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krause. Stay healthy, stay happy, stay safe, stay weird, and we'll talk to you again soon.